guess it's over now. There's no getting back to good. That's Matchbox 20, an album that I played the heck out of while playing NHL 2000, way back in an unfinished basement in Cambridge, years and years and years ago. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Blue Jays once again flirted with getting back to 500, but as so many flirtations go, they came up short. Spirited ninth inning comeback. Probably asking a little too much of this offense when they had put up no offense to that point. It comes up just a little bit short on a very loud final out from Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who was pinch hitting. The Brewers take 2 of 3. That ends the road trip for the Blue Jays at 3-3. They return home for a tough 6-game homestand here, exactly where they left off. Still trying to get back to good. Still trying to get back to 500. Lots to dissect from that one and set up with the Guardians and Red Sox in town over this next week. So let's not waste any time. Let's go to Keegan Matheson, our pal at MLB.com, at BlueJays.com. Fresh from one of your favorite places, man. How was Milwaukee? How was Green Bay Packers country?
I love Milwaukee. It's my bias showing, absolutely. But I had a great time. That's one of my new favorite stadiums as well. I somehow had dodged that for the first few years on the beat. But love the stadium, love the people. I think I survived for 3 days on cheese curds and Miller Lights. I don't know why I feel so good today, but I was among my people. It was a good life for a few days. If you can do the Milwaukee trip, do it. Good time.
I have been there. I saw Ali Khan, who runs the Blue Jays social media, got to go down the slide. Did you dabble?
Yeah. No chance. That thing is so high up in the air. On TV, it looks like it's just above the wall. I have a crippling fear of heights. Like if I were to stand on a chair to change a light bulb, I am extremely afraid. So I was not touching that. I remember back to a couple of years ago, Blake. Remember when that TV reporter came down a little too hard and either sprained or broke his ankle? I'm aware I'm a bit of a bigger fella. I would probably generate a lot of momentum going down that slide, and I'd probably turn into a story, which is not my goal.
Well, we did see the Brewers mascot, Bernie Brewer, go down the slide because Willie Adames hit a very big home run in that game.
Massive.
Yeah. My goodness. It was a big shot in a 5-run sixth inning. The Jays enter the ninth down 5-1. We're all getting our sarcastic tweets off. And yeah, I mean, we almost had to delete them or reword them. The Jays start off with the three Buffalo guys kind of stringing some hits together. Ernie Clement, Spencer Horwitz, Davis Schneider. And then the bigger bats in the Blue Jays lineup come up. Bo Bichette, Danny Jansen, George Springer, Alejandro Kirk, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. The Jays had a lot of chances at it, put a couple runs on the board, had the bases loaded with nobody out. They weren't able to get it done. You tweeted, this would have been one of their biggest wins of the season. It was not. How was the vibe? How was the energy around the team in the clubhouse after that one? That felt close, but we've felt close a lot of times this year already.
Kind of a case of, you know, this again.
Yeah.
Really for the offense. And yes, it's encouraging that they came back and scored a few runs late, but good teams don't care about that. The Dodgers, the Phillies, they don't care about coming close. And I know that for a while, those kind of silver lining wins have been a thing for the Blue Jays. They can't be anymore. You need to win real baseball games. And that rally in the ninth, the Buffalo guys, like you said, Blake, now they weren't all rockets into the gaps, but whatever. You take base hits how you can get them. And the lineup, how it shaped up after that, I thought was really interesting because it kind of got to this balance the Blue Jays are trying to strike right now. You had Kirk coming up on deck there. You had Kiermaier behind him. And it was a case of where are the Blue Jays going to use Vladdy? It was interesting that was a bit of a decision with George Springer. Now, I think that was a good spot to use Vladdy. There's a bit of hindsight bias involved in that, of course, looking at how Springer's at-bat went, which was not good. But it got to the struggle that this offense still has when you have some of those empty at-bats strung throughout it. And when, Blake, you have three base hits, when you're not hitting for power, you need those to pile up a little bit quicker. It's hard to string together 5-6 singles against an MLB reliever, especially at the back end of a bullpen. You need some power involved. You need base hits earlier in this game so that Chris Bassitt does not have to carry this team on his back again and again and again. It's taken different shapes, but it's kind of the same story that we've been talking about all year. The offense asked its pitcher to be perfect Chris Bassett was kind of his own version of perfect. It was a very Chris Bassett start. But it's back in the same spot that we've talked about 50 different times this year, which is a low-scoring offense until the very end that was asking the rest of the team to be perfect. And when that happens, anything that goes wrong is magnified 10 times because anything that goes wrong is immediately the reason that the game goes wrong. It's a tough way to live as a baseball team, a tough way.
Yeah, and look, there are 54 outs at a baseball game, 51 in some of them. And look, I get it. Like sometimes we'll talk about the offense on a day the pitching was bad and people will be like, well, it wouldn't have mattered. The pitching gave up. Or we'll talk about, hey, you know, this pitcher struggled with this thing. Well, what does it matter? They didn't score enough runs. We still got to talk about all this stuff because you don't know. You can't control. If you're a hitter, you can't control what Chris Bassett is going to do. You can help him out a little bit in the field, but you can't go up there and be like, we only need two runs today. Chris Bassett's going to throw five shutout and strand nine runners because that's what Chris Bassett does sometimes while he's, I think, chewing the nub off of his finger over the course of a start. So I do want to revisit that ninth inning. So you mentioned there that there's an argument to be made. Bases loaded, nobody out after you've already cashed a couple there. To pinch hit Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for George Springer. And what they're probably looking at there is we've got three outs left, and it's Springer's spot in the order, Kirk's spot in the order, and then at that point in time, Kiermaier's spot in the order. You know they're not going to make a pitching change. Trevor McGill just came in, and even if you got to the fourth hitter, they're not taking McGill out of that game. So you have a good idea of what this looks like. I would imagine part of the decision is if you use Vlad in the Springer spot, you have two double play risks back-to-back with Guerrero and Kirk. So maybe you only get two hitters up. Springer obviously has hit the ball on the ground more this year as well, but he's a little faster. Maybe you're a little less worried about it. The counter to that would be in Vlad and Kirk, you have two guys who have, yes, they're double play threats, but in Vlad's case, hits the ball very, very hard and very, very far. And in Kirk's case, has shown an ability to do that situational, hey, getting it in the air is not my first priority, but situationally, I can do that. Do you think you would have pinch hit Vlad for Springer? The other component here is, even though George Springer has been moved down in the lineup, he's George Springer, and they have an element of respect for George Springer and hope that he gets out of it. What did you make of that decision? Where do you think you would have leaned? Again, acknowledging the hindsight bias that you did.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to this. If George Springer's name is not George Springer and his contract looks like something closer to my contract than his, then the math changes really quickly. That's a factor in all of this. It has to be. And another factor is that this is an opportunity, regardless of who Springer is in his contract and stature, that's an opportunity to get a guy going. Ideally, you're not looking for those on, June 12th. But this is the reality they're in, and that was an opportunity for him to get going. But he looked really overmatched in that at-bat. That was a tough one for Springer, especially that final pitch that went by him. It didn't look good. I am always leaning a bit more to the aggressive side of make your move on your terms, make your move first, instead of waiting a little bit longer to make what might be a perfect move. I always lean a bit more to the aggressive side. I was sitting in the press box with Shai Davidi next to me. Poor Shai stuck on another road trip in a strange American city with me for 3 days. But as that was unfolding, I was, as Shai was working and I was grumbling and complaining in his ear, as we often do, I was saying at the time, I think I would really consider getting Vladdy into this spot right here. And that's as much about, maybe more about Vladdy than Springer here. Vladdy is hitting the ball in the air a bit more. Yeah, they're mostly line drives that stay in the air for a second, but in the air, he's in a good stretch right now. I like who Vladdy is as a hitter these last few weeks. I thought that was a good spot for him. And then having Kirk behind that was another option, but Kirk's been good lately as well. It was just one that really, I think, cracked open and displayed the difficult choices I think that John Schneider and Mattingly and the rest of the staff have with this lineup, where there's not a lot of perfect solutions. And even on a day where you have your best player available to pick up and drop in anywhere you want in the biggest inning of the game, still not exactly a perfect answer there. And it unraveled quickly. Buffalo guys nailed it, and it unraveled quick.
And of course, Vlad, didn't get the job done. He hit the ball almost 400 feet off a 100-mile-an-hour pitch from McGill there. And yeah, if he's in the Springer spot, that's a sack fly. And then the Kirk sack fly, obviously we can't play it out that way, but perhaps it works out that way. Would it surprise you? I think this would surprise listeners based on the responses that we get and the tweets that I see in your mentions and stuff like that. Would it surprise you to know that for the season, Vlad has pretty good numbers in high leverage situations? It has not felt like that to me lately. And then I looked it up this morning to try to kind of confirm what I was feeling and what I was going to say. I was like, no, he's actually been better in leverage spots. Does that surprise you to hear?
It does, because I don't think there have been many like signature moments. So I would assume that, you know, there haven't been the walk-offs, the game-changing home runs. But so I would assume that some of those are more moving the game along or keeping it tight. But that does surprise me, because we have not had that big Vladdy walk-off interview, this is my house type moment like we've had in a lot of recent years.
Okay, so Jays don't get enough offensively. After the game, Chris Bassitt, who again threw five shutout innings, he has thrown, I think, four of his last five or four of his last six starts have been shutouts, and he does not have a lot of W's to show for that so far this season. He had a quote after the game to you guys. Our starters have got to be good. That's just the reality of our team. Our starters have to be good, and I feel like we've done a better job over the last month of doing that. He's right. The starting pitching over the last month plus has like a 2.78 ERA. It's been really, really good. I think second in the league only to the Yankees. But in the way that he said that, and I know he was being careful, but was your read on that, like, is that the closest we're going to get to someone calling it out that, yeah, this offense isn't very good and it's on those four starting pitchers to be like, hey, 2.78 ERA over the course of a month got you a little over 500 during that stretch. Like, these guys have to be unbelievable.
Yeah, Chris Bassitt does not say anything by accident, I think is the best way I would put it. Just prior to that, Shai had asked him a question about working out of jams, like he did so many times yesterday. And instead of launching into a quick, boring answer, Chris stood there for a good 8-9 seconds and kind of craned his neck around like you've all seen on the mound before. He started with a long, let me see. Like, if he's answering a question, he's thought about it. And that was a very interesting answer. And I think a good one. I think that was a good way to toe the line of not going too far. You're not dumping on your own teammates, but you're acknowledging it as a reality, his word, which it is. It absolutely is. For a pitcher, that has to be exhausting, because it matters when these guys are given a 5-run lead and you can coast a bit. You can throw a bunch of fastballs at 98% and get through a couple of innings without the mental strain, without the physical strain. Maybe you can cut your start short a little bit, give off to the bullpen instead of needing to throw 105. It is something that builds up over a season. I really think it is. And coming off last year, where this was a bit of a talking point, not as much, but these guys had a massive workload as well. Gausman, Kikuchi, Berríos as well. Over and over, if we are talking about this, the guys that are going through it certainly are feeling it. So I think what Bassitt said was a really good balance. And I think most folks who watch him or have watched his interviews know at this point, he's a smart guy and he is a thoughtful guy. It often comes out on the mound in, you know, what John Schneider loves making jokes about with his mannerisms, like he's being sent off to war sometimes, Schneider likes to say. But it's if he's saying something, he has thought about it. And I think that was a good balance he hit while acknowledging the reality, and it's a reality that sucks if you're a Jays starting pitcher, because they are pitching so well and they're not getting much for it.
So the trio of Berríos, Bassitt, and Kikuchi have all made 14 starts. Only Logan Webb in all of Major League Baseball has made 15. So none of these guys have missed a turn. Gausman's going to make his 14th start on Friday. So we'll have four guys who, and remember, last year they were the first team in years to have four starters throw 30 or more starts. And my takeaway at the end of the season was like, I don't know if we're ever going to see this again in baseball, just given what we see with pitchers. Well, they're on pace again. So those four guys will have each made 14 starts by Friday. Their ERAs range from 2.93 to 4. Their win totals, and I know we don't do pitcher wins because there's not a ton of, like, we know that's not a good way to evaluate a pitcher, but it can tell you something about the way the team is playing and probably how it feels to leave that mound. So four guys starting every fifth day without question with an ERA between 2.93 and 4, and they have win totals of 4, 5, 5, and 6. That's got to be frustrating. It's got to be like you kind of alluded to there, Keegan. Like there is a mental toll to this and also probably a toll to when we look at those innings numbers that those guys have pitched. Yeah, they didn't miss any starts last year. They haven't missed any starts this year. And every inning you're pitching is like that's a, if we're talking like fatigue units or whatever the biomechanists quantify the workload as, like, these are high stress innings these guys are pitching too. Yeah. No one's ever pitching like no one's ever going up there and like, oh, I can gear down 2 miles an hour because I've got a foot. No one can Jack Morris this and downshift because you've got a lead. Like, that's got to have an impact long term.
It has to. These innings add up when you don't get a break to coast throughout that. Physically, it has to add up. When every single pitch you are locked in and maxing out, that's what a lot of the conversations about pitcher health are around now, is how much pitchers are maxing out for those peak effort, max effort innings. And mentally, this has to be tough too. I mean, anyone listening, think of it in your own job. If you do a great day of work at your own job and the guy next to you doesn't, and you have to fall down a bit with that, you know, it's tough regardless of what your job is. And probably a little tougher when there is a few hundred thousand people watching you do your job, which I can't relate to. But these high stress innings are real. They are tough to measure, but players talk about it. Coaches talk about it. It does matter. And along the way, Blake, even forget the stress of it all. These pitchers deserve to have a bad outing that they just win. They deserve to win a 7-6 ball game. Chris Bassett should be able to go out there and allow 5 runs, but still kick it into Bassett mode, grind out 6 innings, and get a win. There have not been many of those pleasant surprises for the pitchers this year. And like you said, with those 30-plus start numbers off the top, Blake, I think we had that conversation after the season. Like, this doesn't happen in Major League Baseball, especially with their inning totals. Their top 4 pitchers last year, whatever it was, 700 and some innings, that was the most by a top 4 in a long, long, long time. That stuff does not repeat itself often, especially with the same 4 guys on the same team the next year. Like, you are pushing what we see from major league starters and the human body, frankly. So the Jays need to give these guys a break. They need to give them a mental break, and they need to reward them for being the best part of this team. The Blue Jays have built a fantastic rotation. And Blake, the last thing I'll compare it to, and I think we've done this before, is the 2021 lineup, that amazing lineup that didn't go anywhere. These are the things you look back on 10 years from now and think, how the hell didn't that group, that lineup, that rotation, how didn't they get a legitimate shot to take a run at this? That's the groups that you compare them to for years and years and years. 10 years from now, we might be looking at this rotation and saying, wow, imagine that group on this team. These things don't happen all the time. You need to cash in on them.
No, to have what that rotation did last year and what they've done so far this year, and you come up with zero playoff wins and maybe not even a playoff appearance this year, it would be one of the biggest squanderings of a strength for a team that I can remember, certainly. Okay, so the offense hasn't come around. They swapped out Kevin Biggio for Spencer Horwitz. That's helped a little bit. Horwitz has been nice. He's, I don't know if spiritually you like calling a guy up from the minors and immediately he's your best hitter and leading off. But that's where we are. How close do you think we are to subsequent moves like that? Because the Kevin Biggio, choosing to move on from Kevin Biggio, and we don't need to rehash that decision, but it did signal, hey, this is a guy that they've really stuck by, really talked about a lot, and they've decided to move on from him because they need a little bit more offense. They need something different on the roster. Daniel Vogelbach continues to have nice plate appearances and hit the ball hard, but not actually have a lot of production. Justin Turner has been a little bit better, but that's mostly come against lefties. George Springer, like we talked about, on merit, should be getting pinch hit for in a clutch spot in the 9th inning. I'm not suggesting any of those guys are, well, maybe Vogelbach would lose his roster spot potentially, but in terms of shifting the playing time even further, like, George Springer is still 4th on the team over the last month in playing time. Justin Turner has come down a little bit, but he's still, you know, in there more often than not. How close do you think we are to subsequent moves like Horwitz for Biggio?
That door is open now, I think. And the Blue Jays are not a team to quickly open that door. We've seen that over the years. They like to drag it on a bit longer than some teams and bet on their own guys. You've heard 1,000 versions of that quote from John Schneider, from Ross Atkins. But you need to accept the realities of your roster. George Springer is batting 198. His OPS is under 600. Yes, he does make some good defensive plays when he's around the ball. So there's a bit of value there, and I understand the value of experience. But you need to hit. The Blue Jays' struggles are not complicated. They just need to hit, period. There's no grand scheme in all of this that people need to understand. They just got to hit. If they hit, they will win. They'll make the playoffs. Everything else is good enough. Their pitching is amazing. The bullpen, we'll see. The defense is elite. They just got to hit. And that should be a pretty simple thing to address if you have other options. Now, looking down to AAA, that would probably be Addison Barger ahead of Aroldis Martinez still right now. Just given that he's a bit more experienced, Aroldis' defense in second is still a little choppy. That's Aroldis Martinez would be kind of the Hail Mary play. You hope that he hits five home runs in the first couple weeks he's up. Whereas Addison Barger, you'd hope that second trip up here, those big exit velocities, the big biceps turn into some sort of offense. But you've got to be entertaining that right now. It is June 13th. It's no longer early. I mean, that died 2 months ago. It's no longer the season of waiting for a guy to turn it around. You are a lot of ball games into the season, close to 70 games. And again, this is, we've talked about this, Blake. This is not having 4 months of a season left. You've got 6 weeks. Like, this team needs to decide who and what they are in front of the trade deadline. And you got to probably decide that a few days ahead so you can contact teams. There's not a ton of time left here to pick a direction for the season. Yes, I know that in the current wildcard format, if you show up and remember your jersey, you've got a chance. But the Blue Jays are kind of hovering on that line of needing to make a decision on, you know, how much can you believe in this roster, believe in this offense. There are a couple of other things they can do, like Horwitz. That one's worked. I really like Horwitz as a hitter. I think if you give him some run, he sticks in the big leagues. Somebody like a Barger might be next in line for that when you look down to AAA. And if this continues with a lot of these veteran guys, older veteran guys, it's going to start becoming uncomfortable. I think the spotlight will stick on them a little bit more going forward unless this turns around.
Yeah, and look, it's not going to get any easier. It's got to turn around pretty quickly here. Like you said, the Cleveland Guardians are very, very good and have, like, by far the best bullpen in baseball. So for a team that has struggled to score early, this is maybe not the best series for them. And then you've got the Red Sox in town, who you're one spot behind. If we talk about that wild card and you've got to jump teams to get back in it, the Red Sox got to deal with the Yankees this weekend. So maybe you come in and that series is a chance to jump them meaningfully. But yeah, it's not getting any easier, man. Keegan Mathieson, thank you for taking the time out this morning. I'll see you down at the park tomorrow.
You got it, buddy. We'll see you there.
Keegan Mathieson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Make sure you are checking out all of his great work and subscribing to his BlueJays.com newsletter. Of course, keep an eye out for pre-sale information for his Blue Jays book that will be coming out in 2025 called The Franchise, Toronto Blue Jays, as well. So yeah, the Jays have the Guardians. We'll spend more of tomorrow's show teeing that one up because the Blue Jays are off today. It is a very good Guardians team, though. They've outscored opponents by 90. They're 43-23. Yeah, they play in the AL Central, but they're 32-17 outside of the Central. They're 15-8 against teams that are above 500. This is a really good team. Top five in offense and top five in run prevention. Number one bullpen in the league. Yeah, they're good. They're good. Another team kind of like the Brewers that is doing what the Jays on paper have said they're going to do, but doing a better job of it and doing it less expensively with a better farm system. So it's a little frustrating to run into those two teams back to back there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to the front office side of things. We're going to talk to Kylie McDaniel of ESPN, their MLB insider, who has also worked in a handful of MLB front offices. We'll talk to him about the state of the Blue Jays. We'll take a look at this weekend's NCAA College World Series begins and what that means for the draft in July and things like that. We'll also talk to him about Rintaro Sasaki, who Yusei Kikuchi was asked about recently. If you haven't seen, Sasaki was expected to be the number one pick in the NPB draft in Japan in 2023. He spurned playing in Japan to go to Stanford. He hasn't debuted in the NCAA yet. That won't happen until the fall, but he's playing right now in the MLB Draft League, which lets some college-eligible players mix in with pros and other draft-eligible amateurs. He is a fascinating prospect for deeper into the future. Also someone who his father coached Yusei Kikuchi and Shohei Ohtani in high school, and someone who Kikuchi has talked about. He hopes to at some point get the pitch against him in his career. So we'll talk about Sasaki. We'll talk about the College World Series. We'll talk about the state of the Blue Jays with Kylie McDaniel. And then Chris Black will be with us for the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Things not going super well for the Blue Jays. They had 3-3 road trip, but against Oakland, you would have hoped to do a little better. And yeah, I don't put much in the, we had to come back off the West Coast and things like that. Your offense can't get out of first gear. You only scored 8 runs over 3 games against Milwaukee. And yeah, that's a nice Milwaukee team that gets it done with defense and base running and a pretty deep lineup there. Not exactly the Jays rotation that they went up against there in Milwaukee. So a little disappointing there. They'll get a day off today before 6 at home against the Guardians and the Red Sox. Those Red Sox, by the way, playing against the Yankees this weekend. So maybe some room for the Jays to move up a little bit in the AL East, a little in the AL wildcard picture, if they can take care of business against the Red Sox. Next week, they got to handle the Guardians first. Speaking of those Yankees, Kylie McDaniel, ESPN insider, author of Future Value, former front office for 4 different major league teams, made what I assume is a big mistake in dipping your toe in the New York speculation scene yesterday and writing about Juan Soto's next contract. Kylie, how you doing, man? Thanks for doing this.
Doing good. Thanks for having me. Yeah, my mentions were kind of a nightmare the last few days.
Yeah, I guess this is what you do when you talk about Yankees baseball. And look, everything's going super well for the Yankees right now. So I assume their fans are like 1% more normal than usual, which puts them at like 1% normal. But yeah, you wrote about Juan Soto and what his next contract could look like. Obviously, he's an impending free agent. Boras clients historically have not done many in-season extensions. The Yankees historically haven't done many in-season extensions. High level, what are we looking at here in terms of the Juan Soto situation once this season wraps up?
So part of the reason I did this exercise, I mean, I kind of lucked out. My editors were pleased that the last 3 seasons at around this time, we've had a huge hitter free agent coming up that is worthy of having the pull of the industry. What does everybody think he's going to get? Because there's not really an easy comp. So it was Aaron Judge 2 years ago, Shohei Ohtani last year, and now it's Soto this year. And then when I was writing the intro to the Soto piece, it was one of the best hitters of this generation, one of the youngest guys to hit free agency. His agent is Scott Boras, the most famous agent in sports. He's on the most famous team in sports. They have the best record in baseball. He's on a heater right now. It was sort of like, you know, the headline kind of writes itself and the intro writes itself. And if you're going to click on it, you know, this is the situation to do it. But the short version of the sort of first half of the article is basically there hasn't been somebody with this sort of resume going into free agency since Bryce Harper and Manny Machado 5 off seasons ago, because they are almost exactly the same age. But both of those players had less accomplishments as measured by WAR before hitting free agency. And the market has jumped significantly in those last 5 years. So you could then argue that both the number and the years should be higher, and the market's gone higher. And so then how do you actually adjust for that when there's been no data points in the last 5 years? And that's kind of what the whole premise of the article is trying to figure out how much it's going to move.
And I imagine Scott Boras will have one opinion on how that should move, and then other people will have other opinions on that. So you did, in writing about this, you know, and this is, I mean, I love your work generally, but this is what good free agency speculation articles look like, is, yeah, you talk to like 25, 30 people around Major League Baseball about what they think this next contract could look like. And there was a wide range there. So for anyone who didn't see the article, go check it out. But three responses came in at over $600 million. 3 came in at under $400 million, and then everyone else was kind of in the middle with an average of around, yeah, like 12 years, $500 million-ish, maybe 13 years, $500 million-ish. Given what we just saw for Shohei Ohtani, is that, like, is $500 million, if we use that as a bar heading into the offseason, is that kind of like a fair anchor, the impression you get from everyone right now?
Yeah, I'd say about half of the projections were some version of 12 years for $500 million, you know, give or take a year, give or take $10 or $20 million, give or take one or two on the AAV, average annual value. That was where almost everybody got. And ironically, I thought it was interesting because I interviewed Scott Boras for this, and he wasn't super thrilled with what I was doing. And I was like, I mean, if you're not going to tell me what he's going to get, Brian Cashman's not going to tell me what he's getting, Juan Soto's not going to tell me what he's going to, like, I got to ask somebody. And I, rather than one person, I'm going to ask a bunch of people. Like, that seems fair to me. But I was like, in your defense, I thought what it would be is all the team side people go really low. All the agents go really high because they want the market to be high and they want to set expectations high to sort of set up Boras for a mistake. And that's like the opposite of what happened. What turned out is everybody played it straight. Even some people that I thought didn't like Boras and would sort of do like troll guesses didn't really do them. And when I asked them why, they were like, I'm trying to guess what it's going to be. I'm trying to be right. And the agent's job is so much to understand comps and expectations that the agents were almost all clustered around 12 for 500. And nobody was told what the average was when they put in their guess. It was just sort of off on their own. And then the team-based guys that are maybe not like GMs, AGM, special assistants, those are the ones that were sort of all over the place based on all kinds of different guys, thinking about outlier contracts, things like that. So I thought it was really interesting trying to put together like where the clustering was and what that means. And then I thought the most intriguing part of this is that how many of these teams are actually going to bid like 450 plus and actually be in that conversation or that potential bidding war. There's going to be like three, maybe four owners, maybe one or two that basically get to decide, is it going to hit 500 or not? And I think that's sort of like the general mark. That's sort of the speculation in the industry is that 500 is the number that Boras has been, you know, shooting for, that that's been the goal for this the whole time. And if three owners are sort of in the bidding around 450 and I'll just decide, it's going to start with a four, it's not going to start with a five, and he'll just go where he goes, then he's not going to get there. And so as much as you want to talk about the market or the expectation or, you know, these projections were 10% higher, or, you know, this year seems more likely, it's like, yeah, it comes down to a couple people. And if they're all in a bad mood that day, or they all decide they don't like Scott Boras, or they don't think Juan Soto is going to move the value of their franchise if they want to sell it, then it's not going to go there. And then the real question is, what does Scott Boras and Juan Soto do if they have a mark they have to get to and they don't get to that mark? Like, what does a pillow contract look like for a generational 26-year-old hitter? How does that then play out? And does the RSN stuff and the bigger economic sort of situation around baseball, like, how does that play out? Is Steve Cohen going to be irrational this year, or is David Stearns going to be a moderating force? Like, there's like four or five like giant questions that, like, while this is a fun exercise and I think it sets an expectation of what people think he's worth, there's some stuff that you just can't predict that is going to actually decide what happens here.
A fun exercise and a valuable one, and could be an entire chapter in it, like a cognitive psych in sports book about how people make these predictions and all the different factors at play. I love the idea too that even though agents could have alternative motives for giving you certain answers, that it was predominantly the desire to be right that won out. And this is, you know, this is something I'll talk to listeners about sometimes. Is like, yeah, you might think that like people in media or whatever have a bias toward this team or this player or whatever, but like most often, at least for me, like I want to be right. And I'm sure when you do your top 100 prospects, it's like, I want to be right. I want the top 100 prospects 7 years from now to be the top 100 players in the league. So it's fascinating to hear that even agents who I think we assume are more like self-interested than anything else still had that urge to be more accurate than anything. So in terms of the teams that could be involved here, you mentioned Cohen. Obviously, the Mets will be a big player. The Yankees and Mets, the picture you painted was kind of those two will be at the top. But you also mentioned the Blue Jays in there with some other teams as teams that front office executives and agents thought could be in that maybe second tier of Juan Soto contender. Were you surprised to hear the Jays in there? Not surprised given their interest in Ohtani. What did you make of their inclusion in there when they came up?
Yeah, I went out of my way to say that I think it is perceived as Yankees and Mets are like tied for first in terms of like odds that they land him or perceived interest or, you know, whatever you might want to call it. And that the second tier is like very far behind and is a little more speculative. Like the Nats were on there because he's from the Nats. It would be like a nice full circle for them to finish their rebuild, bringing this guy back with a couple core pieces that came from trading him. And they're thinking about selling the team. And this seems like a guy that is like at that tier where it makes it easier to sell the team when you've got a superstar locked up for 10 plus years. So it's like, that was like a very interesting concept to me. that also makes some sense. And I think Toronto, after going after, you know, Otani last year, it certainly seems like they are a team that might be outside of the concept of like, well, are they at an expected value of like 87 wins and this pushes them to like 91? It's like, no, I think they're probably outside of that. I think they're a team trying to put together the pieces to have a monster franchise that can have the marketable pieces and the stars and all these sorts of things, that like who the GM is or what their record was last year is like not really that important. And so the fact that they've already proven they want to do that the same way the Giants have proven going after Judge and going after Correa and some of these guys not landing them, that they are open to doing that, like that kind of means more than, oh, it's a big market team that could use an outfielder. Like that doesn't really mean that much. The fact that teams have been trying to fish in the $300 million waters, you look at the Red Sox, they have a history under this ownership of kind of doing that sometimes, or extending high-end players, not in like the last 5 years, like Trevor Story and then extending Devers is the only time they've really done that. And pretty much everything else has been sort of unwound. So like they're not really seen as being in that pool, whereas Toronto like very recently has a data point of being in that pool. So that's sort of like where that's coming from. Texas has had a lot of Boris clients, obviously won a World Series, has a lot of young players. But then also like, were thought to bring back Jordan Montgomery and then didn't, another Boris client who is now not a Boris client. So like there's, everyone has sort of data points to for and against. And Toronto has like a very big data point that I think was driving with the Otani chase, the thought that like they'll be in the mix here. But I think there's probably still a lot of questions to answer, which I'm sure you can ask those questions and we can try to answer them.
Yeah, let's try to do that. So Juan Soto aside, I mean, man, what do you make of the situation the Blue Jays are in here, where a couple years ago we would have been talking about this sustained window, you know, the Vlad and Bo core and some of those other younger pieces, whether it was, you know, Manoah or whichever of the three catchers hit, Biggio to the extent that you wanted to include him in there as more than kind of just a guy on the roster. And now we're talking about, hey, there were a bad week or two here from maybe selling at the deadline and retooling for 2025. High level, get as specific as you want, but what do you make of this? The Jays' inability really over the last couple of years to cash in on what was supposed to be, you know, you look back to 2021 when they missed the playoffs by a game, that was supposed to be the start, right? And they were looking at close to the end of the window here, potentially, where they haven't won a playoff game and they might be on the outside of the playoff picture this year.
Yeah, I think this is what people in the industry would call like a tough situation, where it is not obvious if you should strip it down for parts and get rid of all of the good players that you can get value for and then try to do a power rebuild, like say what Seattle did, where they kind of get rid of everybody, they get a bunch of prospects, and then like 2 years later is when like when the top prospects and all those guys sort of come up, and then you can, you know, hopefully have like a Kirby, a Gilbert, have like all the prospects come up and be good all at the same time, and then you can weather a Kelnick or somebody that doesn't work. I think that would be like route one. And then route two would be like, we have potential or actual stars, or however you want to describe Bichette and Guerrero and, you know, Gausman, and kind of go through that and be like, and these guys are all on affordable contracts. Next year is the year we're pushing in for, but not just next year. It's sort of like the next 3 years. And then here's like a sort of outline of a plan of, this is how the payroll structure will work. Here's the pieces we have to work around, you know, that sort of thing. And I think you have to pick one of those two. You can't do the like in between. We're both buyers and sellers. We're, you know, we're getting better for the future and for now, because then you're not going to do anything. And also, I feel like the team has been trying to be good in the sort of, you know, 1 to 3 year period, and it hasn't quite worked yet. So I don't think this front office is quite good enough at pulling off these strategies to really try to do both. And I think because Biggio and Guerrero and like the contract Gausman is on, I think those are seen as like sort of attractive enough assets to the team that you should try to get rid of the pieces that aren't important or the expiring contracts or things like that, and then have some very targeted stuff done this offseason to then plateau or to build into what next year can be, and then let next year decide what the plan's going to be after. But I think the sort of posture of the team is, we're a contending team, we're a big market team, we're a higher payroll team, we don't completely bottom out. I think that's like the actual piece of information here that is important, which is you don't get to bottom out in this market. So we're always going to be competitive. We're never going to strip it down for parts. And so when you go back to those like two routes, one of them I think is completely blocked off. I don't think that's a thing they're going to do. I don't think they're going to trade Bichette and Guerrero and get like two or three pretty good prospects, but not like an overwhelming haul. Like that doesn't really solve your problem. It just gives you another one. So I think this is a see it out and try to like figure out ways to, you know, fix it in quotes. The other part, which we can get into, is like the farm system is not that great. There aren't a bunch of like obvious big leaguers that'll be up in the next year or two that are going to solve some of your problems. There's just, it's sort of more supplemental. We can sort of have an extra, you know, some starting pitching depth here, an extra bench guy here. We can save a few dollars on free agency trying to fill every hole, but it's not like you got a bunch of answers waiting to come up, which is part of the reason this is a tough call, exactly how to pull this off.
Yeah, and you look, the farm system is in a not great spot, even if they've graduated some interesting guys like Schneider and Horwitz, and Arelvis is having a nice season and things like that. You know, this is consistently, whether it's you or other outlets, everyone agrees this is a bottom 10 farm system. And maybe this is just because they just played the Brewers and now they're about to play the Guardians. But you do look around and you see other teams that are doing a better job of winning now and using the big budget. You see other teams that are doing a better job of, yeah, we're not going to spend a ton, but we're going to have a good farm system and a consistent pipeline, things like that. Like there are the high-end teams like the Yankees and Dodgers and to a lesser extent the Red Sox who are always contending and they're able to have a good farm system. And then there are like the teams that, you know, the Shapiro-Atkins model from Cleveland was supposed to be, well, look at how we can sustain this. The farm system's deep. We're inexpensive. We make shrewd trades, things like that. Imagine if we had a budget on top of that. Like Andrew Friedman goes Tampa to LA and that's what it looks like. There are a lot of teams who have been able to do better with less than this Blue Jays front office so far. So when you mentioned, you know, you kind of said there, you don't know that this front office is good enough at either direction to try to juggle both. You've been in a couple front offices. You've covered the sport for a long time. How does the fact that there is maybe not long-term certainty or even medium-term certainty with who's going to be making these decisions, like how do you think that colors things for the Jays?
That makes it tricky. I can say with one of the teams that I worked for, this was like, I guess, never really made public, but we were trying to make a trade around the trade deadline. And a team we were dealing with was being sort of irrational. Like they should have been open to either trading or, you know, basically trading a player that they should have been open to trading. And then after the deadline, we call the team back. And, you know, obviously not me, but the GM is sort of like, hey, why wasn't that guy available? And he was like, the GM of the other team was like, oh, I was already pre-fired and told I couldn't make any moves. So I was never going to trade that player. That's why it seemed irrational. I wasn't allowed to do anything. And you guys were being totally rational. I should have made that trade. And like this happens every now and then. I bring that up because I was talking to somebody about like, what are the Jays going to do at the deadline this year? And I was like, like weird stuff like that happens sometimes where it's like, oh, trades should be made. They're not going to be made because they don't want to replace the GM in the middle of the year. But like they know they're going to do it later. I only know of one instance where that happened. But I think we're in that range where that sort of thing, I think, is the questions being asked at the top, which is I don't get the impression that like, you know, the owner's going to change or the president's going to change. But there's been like a lot of runway here to sort of, you know, fix things, have them go the right way, be competitive in the AL East. Now Baltimore sort of come out of nowhere. You sort of lucked out that Tampa Bay isn't super competitive right now in the division. There's a bit of an opening, like the third wild card spot right now on Fangraphs is projected as 84 wins. Like that's a great opportunity to really get there. And Toronto's projected for 81 wins. Like they're in the mix. They're like 20% playoff odds because there's like 10 teams that you could make a case for that last spot. And they're a little behind the mark. So it's like there's also a case to like really go for it and trade prospects and try to make it this year and next year and, you know, do that. But it's like if you're the president or the owner and you aren't sure who the GM's going to be next year, then how do you approach that exact situation where it's like, well, this isn't maybe like the long-term steward of how this is going to go. Maybe we do the let's, you know, let it play out this year and see where it goes, not put our foot on the gas or on the brake. And then next year can be, you know, a slightly different approach or different people in charge or, you know, whatever it might be. But I would also say one of the sort of phrases I always come back to is when there is a team that isn't quite hitting expectations or isn't quite getting the return on their investment, usually the issue is what is their point of view? What are they good at? What are the kinds of players that they're always looking for in trades or in free agency or in the draft? What do they excel at? Are they top five in baseball at any one thing of like the 20 different things you can be good at? And usually when a team is not quite hitting expectations, it's because they don't have a point of view. They're just kind of trying to do everything. They're trying to figure out what their thing is. They're kind of league average, a little above, a little below at everything. And when you're doing that, money doesn't solve the problem. It's you have to figure out your point of view first. And despite, you know, a lot of this front office coming from that Cleveland tree where they really have that figured out, I don't think this Toronto front office has figured that out yet. And I think that's actually the problem.
Yeah. And and it certainly seems that way. You know, 2021, they seem to overcorrect for the fact that that offense was a little boom or bust, maybe too many strikeouts and home runs, guys, but now they can't hit home runs. They have good swing decisions, but nobody does damage. You know, I guess the one strength would be they've hit really well on free agent starting pitchers, which is probably the hardest thing to do, but it's also probably the least sustainable skill you can have as a front office, right? Because so much comes down to starting pitching, injury attrition, and things like that. Kylie, last one on the Jays for you, but you mentioned, you know, the farm system is not in the greatest of shapes, and this idea of having an identity and what do you do well. You know, my read from talking to you and other people has been, yeah, the Jays on the draft side, you know, quick through the minors, hit tool, college bats, that maybe don't have a ton of upside. Do you think that where the Jays farm system is, you know, ranking wise and depth wise, is a product of like, hey, they just really haven't swung for upside? Like, obviously that's an oversimplification, but why do you think it is that this Jays farm system really hasn't moved from that kind of 20 to 25 range in the 8 years or so this front office has been at the helm?
They actually do a version of what I've noticed Cleveland do, which Cleveland is like sort of known for. They take the medium stuff guys with command, college pitchers, rounds like 4 through 20, and we'll get like two real big leaguers out of that group every year. But somewhat interestingly, in the first two or three rounds, they go with the big stuff guys, the Daniel Savino, Gavin Williams, you know, Tanner Burns, those kinds of guys. Toronto has had some sort of, you know, risky upside guys, both internationally and in the draft. Early on, Arjun Amala, Emmanuel Bonilla, I guess technically all like international signees, if they're not the 20-year-old Cuban guys, tend to be sort of risky and are going to take longer. And then rounds, you know, two or three and on, it's a lot of more, you know, generic college guys, the hit tool first types that don't have a ton of upside but have a chance to be big leaguers. There's been some, you know, sort of later round finds that have made the big leagues and guys like David Schneider that like weren't expected to be that good. They took a gamble on a trade on a stuff guy in Adam Macko who hasn't been that healthy, who's now pitching pretty well. So it's like, it's not like they're doing one thing and it's not working. They're kind of doing a bunch of different things. And I know like the rumors going to the draft this year is they're looking at a bunch of college hitters because that's kind of what the board gives you. And so it's like kind of predictable. And I know some teams I talked to were just sort of like, yeah, they, you know, they signed, you know, Justin Turner in free agency, and they kind of went through some of the more conservative moves like Kiermaier, like just trying to get a part-time guy for, you know, some real money. And they're just like, yeah, you look at, you know, Tommy White or some of the guys that are available at these picks. It's just sort of like, yeah, they're kind of, you know, flawed and have like medium upside, and like that's the kind of guys they're looking at, whereas last year it was, you know, more high-end high school upside types, and so that's what they took. And so like I guess that sort of underlines what I was saying, where it's like, it's sort of like you're letting the tides kind of move you around. Whatever's there is what you take, which is fine. You should sort of take what the board gives you rather than trying to fight it and like force something else. But if you're not finding success, maybe you should, you know, develop that point of view and figure out what's going to work for you. Because I think that also goes back to, you know, the Biggio and Bichette and Guerrero either stalling out, getting worse, plateauing, however you want to describe their development, the big leagues, that sort of big league development. Berríos hasn't like really gotten a ton better the last couple of years when it seemed like he was ready to break through and was sort of paid as though he would. I think that also extends to the big leagues, which is what you see with some of these really good organizations, is everyone in the big leagues is kind of getting better or trying something. And then in the minor leagues, there's like one or two guys kind of popping up at all times that are like getting better. There's some 13th rounder that now other teams want. I think development as like a big umbrella is like actually the answer to your question. And how do you make players better? And that's like a really dense, complicated problem to solve. Just like, how do you make baseball players better? But I think that's like, maybe if you're trying to zero in on what it is, I think that's the thing that's sort of affected this outcome the most.
Yeah, you could, I mean, if you were going to really dive deep on that, you would have to write an entire book, and maybe you'd call it Future Value, The Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. I don't know, maybe you would. Yeah, there you go. There you go. Maybe that's what you do with it. Okay. You mentioned that the draft is coming up. So tomorrow is the beginning of the College World Series. Obviously, it's been going on for a couple weeks now, but we've got the Nebraska kind of week of finals here. You, from a getting ready for the draft standpoint, given the amount of like data and tech we have now that's bled into the college game, like it seems like we have more information on a lot of these players than we would have maybe half a decade or a decade ago. How much does tournament time still move the needle for front office executives in terms of how they're setting up their board in a couple weeks?
There are certainly examples. I know Cade Horton with Oklahoma was an example where he was seen as a third-round pick in the middle of the spring. And then the way he finished the season, went into the postseason, and then all the way into the College World Series, finished so well. He had returned in the middle of the spring from Tommy John surgery. So he obviously had like a lack of sample, and then gave you the sample and continued improving and continued doing it over and over. And he went from third round to second round to, oh, maybe the first round to the seventh overall pick. Will Bednar, I think that's now 5 years ago, same kind of idea. It was like, oh, like nice second round, maybe comp round college pitcher, and then eventually gets his way up to like 15th overall as he performs down the stretch. Horton looks like he'll be a good big leaguer. Bednar, maybe not quite as much. So there's, you know, pluses and minuses to that as well. There are guys, I think Kentucky outfielder Ryan Waldschmidt is maybe a good example of that, where he's been slowly building momentum throughout the year, has been a little more of a numbers-based guy. But if you look at his like advanced numbers, just like the TrackMan and stuff like that, it says he's like just right-handed Bazana, and that is not the way he is perceived, but I think some teams perceive him that way. And so I think the more the teams are getting in rooms and having the conversation that they, you know, had Waldschmidt as a second round pick a month ago, and then slowly started getting better and better reports, the buzz around the industry is getting better and better, and all of a sudden a team picking 14 might be talking about Waldschmidt, or he wasn't even close to being in an extended group a month ago. It's not that he wasn't good enough. It's that he continued doing it on the big stage while the decision makers are kind of watching these games closely, as opposed to only watching big league games. And then it just sort of became more and more obvious, and it makes it easier to pick the guy, which might sound like a bad process that 1 month of playing in college makes the difference. But if you just think like the guy making the pick in the first round doesn't know the name of a guy that's 45th on your board and you're picking 15th, and then this guy gets red hot and nobody's got like a negative other than we didn't have him here to start the year, you can kind of see how logically maybe he should have been 15th the whole spring and it just took us a while to get here and this was the right answer all along. That's the kind of thing that happens where the momentum gets a little more runway to play itself out, and those sort of human conversations about like, how do you solve this problem and what's this hole and can we fix that? Oh, he hit 3 home runs last night in Omaha. That seems like a pretty good data point. Like sometimes guys can make a couple million dollars if they really line this up perfectly.
Yeah, and there are just so many guys to know and keep an eye on too, like even for front offices that, yeah, I'd imagine there's some velocity to like it, two conversations about a guy. Last one for you before I let you go here, Kylie. This is not 2024 MLB draft relevant, but Rintaro Sasaki made his stateside debut in MLB Draft League this week. So for anyone who doesn't know, he was supposed to be the top prospect in the NPB, decided not to play in Japan and enter that draft. He's going to Stanford. Just how good a prospect are we talking here? And what is the timeline like for Sasaki to be major league draft eligible, given that he's not even NCAA eligible just yet?
So I actually was asking some scouts about this yesterday because I talked to a scout that was at the draft league game. I don't know if he's going to be sophomore or junior eligible at Stanford. He'll play at least 2 years there, but it might be three based on what his age is. Or I know there's been some players in the past from Canada where they have like a post-grad year that is not obvious or like noted in a way where the guys have been surprisingly eligible. Like Edward Julian with the Twins was a guy where he was eligible a year before everybody thought, and teams found out like a month before the draft he was eligible. And luckily he'd been very productive at Auburn, so everyone knew who he was. But there's actually a high school guy that will be drafted this year, probably get $1 million, that like an email was sent to teams at this point last year saying he's not actually eligible, and all the teams were like, he was eligible? Like they didn't know. So I don't know if there's a Japanese version of that, because to go to Sasaki's situation, there have not been guys that are really good in MPB or as MPB draft prospects at high school that then come play over here at college. Like there's been a handful, like 10, 15th rounders, like not really good players, but there have been some players that have done it, usually have sort of family reasons and things like that. And when I was writing him up, when the sort of news broke that he was taking, you know, visits and then eventually went to Stanford, I was expecting scouts to tell me, because like he's, you know, on the Husky side, there's like visually a little bit of Vogelbach to it. I was expecting them to say, oh, it's like a maxed out body, big power, sure, a little bit of a hitter, but feels like a third to fifth rounder, like not the kind of guy you ever get really excited about. I got a couple answers from teams that are really sharp in the international area that are prepared for guys 5 years in advance in the, you know, Latin America, that really know all the players in Asia really well. And they were like, we're not saying he's like Vlad Jr., but like there's a little more of that going on than you think. There could be like a rare amount of bat control, a really good approach, giant power, and Prince Fielder, like throw some names around like that where it's like a not perfect frame, but at 16, 17, 18, it's very obvious this guy's really good. They were kind of throwing those names around, suggesting that if this guy was eligible to sign as an international player, it would be $3 or $4 million, which generally does not happen for guys of this size at this age. And the examples include guys like Vlad Jr. and you know, guys like that, that, you know, tend to be a little bit better. Cause if you're that good at that size at that age, like that's, you're sort of way outside of the idea of comps and, you know, the typical player that gets signed. So I'm paying very close attention to him because, not just because of all the sort of social stuff that is like very interesting and like what kind of NIL money does he get, or all the billboards in Japanese and Stanford next year in the outfield, but also he might be really, really good, but he's been facing a lot of like 85 mile an hour fastballs. And so the draft league is exactly the kind of thing we need to see, where there's a lot of dudes that don't have a ton of command but throw 94 with a decent breaking ball. He'll be seeing the guys that will actually tell us what kind of guy he is. And the early returns are, oh, this guy's like probably very good. I don't know if he's top of the first round or late first round or top of the second round, but he's somewhere in that conversation. Like, he's a real guy to follow. This is not like a circus act that only the like demographic stuff is making it interesting. He's actually very good.
Which is really exciting. Obviously not a ton of eyes on MLB Draft League necessarily game to game, but certainly a reason to pay some attention, box score watch, keep the highlights going. And then, yeah, next year at Stanford. Kylie McDaniel, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. I can hear the dogs upstairs complaining, so I got to go let them out now.
All right. Kylie McDaniel, ESPN Insider, author of Future Value, formerly with a couple different front offices, and dog fosterer, all around good guy. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Chris Black joins us in studio for the second hour. JSTOC Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, a little rural Alberta advantage, bringing us back at the request. I mean, I like them too, but at the request of our next guest, Chris Black, at Down to Black on Twitter, king of the Blue Jays threads and producer at Sportsnet. What's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing well. I made it on time. I navigated the Don Valley Parkway and got here. But yeah, rural Alberta advantage, not from Oshawa, but still awesome Canadian content. I've seen them live like 10 times. I saw them in Vancouver during the Olympics, I want to say. Seen them at Hillside, seen them all around Toronto, even saw them in a Royal York ballroom for a Canadian Music Week performance. That was very cool. They're awesome. Again, right in my wheelhouse of like 2000s music. So,
although active, and at least one member, Amy, I know, is a big Jays fan.
So, awesome.
Tie in here to Jays Talk Plus. Some great stuff with Kylie McDaniel and Keegan Matheson. In the first hour there, I want to dig in a little bit with you, Chris, on a couple points from this game. And then we're going to go deep on Bo Bichette and his struggles at the plate this year. But before we do that, I wanted to talk about the ninth inning and the pinch hit kind of sequencing there. And then the double steal that the Brewers pulled off, because there is a lot more to unpack there than just a straight double steal. Let's start with the pinch hit decision. So they saved Vlad with two outs there. You know, Alejandro Kirk does a nice job at least getting the ball in the air, make sure the double play risk is off and things like that. There is a case to be made to have pinch hit for George Springer instead, given the way he's performed. Yes, it introduces some risk with Vlad and two double play threats a little earlier in Vlad and Kirk, but also maybe a little bit more sack fly potential, things like that. What did you make of how they played out that ninth inning from a substitution pattern?
I thought you and Keegan did a good job breaking it down in the first hour. I think it's one of those things where, like, in a vacuum, you could probably make a case for it, but I think big picture, I'm okay with it. Like, also, like, that game, if we can, like, see the forest for the trees for a minute, like, that was really fun. There's a lot to dive into on that game. Obviously, they lose, but, like, as a baseball nerd, that game, there's a lot going on, a lot of decisions, like, text threads with both, like, coworkers and, like, former baseball-playing teammates, like, were, like, long threads for like game 68 of a season on a Wednesday afternoon.
Well, here's the thing about being a very good pitching and defense team that also can't score is every game feels playoffy. You have what, like a 2.78 starters ERA over the last month, but you've only gone like two games over 500 because every game is like 3-2, 3-1. It does make for games where every decision feels really big and you can argue, and that's such a fun thing. But I would say it would be a lot more fun if the Jays were taking more of them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
The roller coaster is a lot you know, nicer if something good happens at the end. But anyways, to answer your question.
Oh, a roller coaster is a bad analogy. Because
yeah, exactly.
If something bad happens at the end, that's
yeah,
really bad.
Exactly.
This is like the one time I was at Darien Lake, and it was the second time I had been there, and both times the Superman ride was shut down. And I was like, no, I want to go on it. I want to do it. And it's like final destinationing me. Like, yeah. Do not go on this thing, man. No. Anyway.
To answer the question, I think I would have done it exactly the way Schneider did it. Like, I think you need to view it in like Grant, not just in the one game aspect. And I think if knowing George's history, even though he hasn't been performing well this year, knowing his like propensity for stepping up in the clutch, knowing what, if he came through, what that might do for jumpstarting his season. Like, I think the upside, and I was thinking about it. So I think reasonable arguments can be made both ways, but I think I like Springer, Kirk, Vlad more than Vlad, Kirk, Kiermaier, if that makes sense, or somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, they had Kiermaier. Nobody else. The bench had been entirely used. Vlad was the last sub. So
yeah, I think I would have leaned the way they did it. And I was even more like, there are double play candidates among all three of those guys of Springer, Kirk, and Vlad. Like, they could all hit into double plays. But the way it played out, yeah, Springer's at bat did not go well, but Kirk hit the ball really hard. Somebody pointed out to me on social that it would have been a home run in five or six ballparks, which I know infuriates some people when you use those stats, because in the ballpark it was in, it wasn't out. but he hit the ball really hard, as he's been doing a lot of late, and Vladdy hit the ball hard. So again, not the result you want, but I think you can't argue with what they did there. Reasonable people can disagree, but I think the logic was okay.
Yeah, and the bigger issue is that you only had one run to that point. Mm-hmm. And then with decisions like this and with batting order and things like that, the core issue is you don't have enough good hitters hitting well right now. You are choosing between options that you're not super thrilled about versus, hey, six guys are hitting the cover off the ball. What's the best way to order them? It's like, no, only three guys are hitting the ball well at a certain time, and we're chasing our tails trying to figure out which it's going to be this week. That's the core issue, is not enough guys are hitting well, and they only had one run to that point. Not necessarily, hey, you chose the wrong spot to pinch.
Yeah, I think for this season, I've landed on batting order is not the issue with the, like, there were some
things. No, every time they move someone up, they get cold. Every time they move someone.
Which is just cyclical baseball, right? Like, that's what happens. So it's more about they just need more guys hitting as opposed to where guys are hitting.
Yes, which is good. They should do that. More guys should hit. The Jays could have potentially saved one extra run in that game by preventing a Brewers double steal in that big five-run sixth inning. So for anyone who doesn't remember, they have Bryce Terang on first and Blake Perkins on third. We've seen the Jays handle the first and third kind of, we'll call it like a bait double steal, where that runner from first is trying to either take second for free or draw a throw down so that the runner from third can go. And the Jays have generally done a good job of mitigating that play. In leverage spots, they have mostly conceded the runner at second base, as most teams do. Pat Murphy from the Brewers explained their side of this as well, which I'll play in a second. But before we get to that, we're going to get into some of the specifics from the thread you had at Down to Black on Twitter earlier today. But what do you make of that at a high level? Like, this is a Brewers team that is by far number one in the league in base running value. They're third in stolen bases, and then they advance the extra base and take the extra bases around the diamond better than just about any team. This had to be on the scouting report. They had to know this was a possibility.
This was the most fascinating play of the game for me, like, easily. It's something Joe Siddle was talking about a lot, something Caleb Joseph was talking about a lot. Two catchers, it makes sense. I'd love to hear Buck Martinez's thoughts about it. He'll be back on the call in maybe a series or two. But just a fascinating, fascinating play. And it's one where, you know, just a few years ago, or especially even like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this was not a Major League Baseball play. This was something you saw in college, high school, junior, that kind of stuff. But because of the offensive environment in Major League Baseball right now, because of the rules designed to help the running game, you're seeing this play more and more. Like, you're seeing it already just a few years ago, maybe 2021, in this kind of leveraged moment, sixth inning or later, two outs, score close. You only saw this maybe 50 times all year. Last year it was 86. And according to Inside Edge, I looked all this up yesterday. Like that play yesterday was already the 40th time we've seen it this year. So it's a play happening with more regularity in higher leverage moments. And the Brewers are one of the more aggressive teams at doing it. So it was a really fascinating play. And there's so many layers to it. But I think, yeah, you mentioned it. Toronto's defended this play really well in the past. It was the first time they've given up a run on a similar play like this in like nearly 2 years. And just the other thing I noticed, like diving in, close to 100 and I think I want to say 125 plays, similar plays over the last 2 years. Barely anyone throws in that situation in leverage, sixth inning or later, again, two outs.
Yeah, not even Real Muto throws, who's kind of the best at
that. So it's generally about 10% of the time they throw through, 90% of the time you concede the run.
Which,
or at least, 90% of the time you concede the base.
Yeah.
Right? And they don't even bother trying to throw, even if it's a cut throw or all the way through. So just very high level, at the very most basic level, you almost never see a team throw through. Like 9 times out of 10, they eat that baseball.
And the reason for that is, well, the potential risk of an error, the potential risk of the guy takes off from third and gets back in time, and your guy either can't cut it off or can't get the throw back in time, that those risks outweigh the value of picking up the trail runner and getting him out. And then, yeah, then there's obviously a scenario with a guy standing on third instead of a guy on the, instead of runners on the corners, but that's the trade-off there. So there is a lot going on here. And when you are Milwaukee, you could be thinking about a couple different things here with this. You have one of the best base running teams in baseball. Bryce Turang is absolutely near the very, very top in every way we can measure speed and base running ability and base stealing and stuff like that. And then Blake Perkins on third is very, very fast and a good base stealer as well. So you might think this is a straight double steal. Maybe it's a case of, hey, the runner from first is going to take off. Blake Perkins has the read. Like he's got the kind of option there to go and see what he sees. In this case, Perkins takes off immediately from third when the throw goes. And there's something interesting that happens with Bryce Turang coming over from first, and it tips the hand as to what Milwaukee was actually trying to accomplish on this play. It wasn't necessary. Obviously, they come up with the double steal. That's effective. That's nice for them. That's a good outcome. But in hearing manager Pat Murphy talk about it after, they were trying to draw the throw, and they were willing to sacrifice the out at second to score that run. Here's Brewers manager Pat Murphy explaining their thinking and strategy after the game.
How close the third baseman is to the bag, how what the pitcher is to the plate to guarantee that are we going to get the base or are we going to stop short if the throw goes through. We study the other team, how they defend first and third. They did a lot of first and third. It's a play where they cut the shortstop in front and actually throw to him, give you the perception that the shortstop's in front. When you see that, the third base coach holds the guy. We knew we had the runner. We had a big enough lead. We know if we get a big enough lead, we know there's a really good chance he's got to make an absolute perfect throw. And with two outs and the way this kid was throwing a ball, I mean, it was like a very slow pace for that kid, but his stuff was running all around and very difficult to hit. So it was a good time for him. And credit our base coaches for recognizing the situation and, bam, putting it on right then. You know what I mean? Credit them for that. And sometimes when we make mistakes, it looks like, sometimes it's not planned that way, but sometimes players misinterpret or get tentative about it, and that's when the play breaks down. Those two guys, that was perfect.
A fascinating explanation there from Pat Murphy. So a couple of the things there. Okay, Perkins is able to get a bigger lead off third because the Jays aren't holding third that well. Zach Pop's been slow to the plate. So the first and third base coach are sitting there with their timers or the times coming from the bench. They know he's slow and deliberate. They've scouted the Blue Jays and how they handle this normally and how they'll reposition fielders in this spot. And you can see Isaiah Kiner-Falefa comes across. Now, the throw is the primary issue here. The throw it's not a great throw, and it kind of bounces off his glove, and that's what allows Turang to advance to third as well. But you see Turang, when IKF comes across and is going to cut it, Turang stops. He's trying to bait IKF into the tag there, even if IKF comes up with it, and Turang's basically surrendering himself and saying, here's an out if you don't throw home with this. What do you make of, you could get that sense watching it back and watching Turang, but then you hear Pat Murphy say it, and yeah, it's pretty clear. They were in full, it wasn't necessarily a double steal. They were ready to trade an out for a run at an early point in the game where I believe is 1-0 Blue Jays.
Yeah, that's the most fascinating part of this entire play to me, in that I'm not even sure I like that decision from Milwaukee. Obviously, this thing goes completely haywire for the Blue Jays. It's the snake guys like outcome. Not only do you concede the run, you don't get the third out and five runs come around to score. Like Milwaukee was willing to concede that out heading to second base in order to tie the game, which to me with Zach Pop, yes, he's got good stuff. Yes, he's been throwing well, but you've also got your best hitter up. Who's a very good hitter, very good situational hitter. If I'm the Blue Jays, like, yeah, you want to execute that play and shot, like get the runner, cut off the runner at home. But like, I'd be okay with that negative scenario of they tie the game up, but you leave that inning tied.
Right. So you're saying if you can get the out there at second base, you allow the run to score, you take the bat out of William Contreras' hands
until the next inning
on base though, because there's two outs.
To me, it's fascinating that it was, if you watch from the high home angle of that play, you'll notice that IKF was not running to cut off the ball ahead of second base right away. It was more of a read and react play, for lack of a better term, where he was kind of going to second base first and was going to read the situation. Now, from my view in Toronto, seems like once he sees runner going and kind of sees that the throw is short, he makes a read to try and move up, take that ball on a short hop, and still make the play at home. Ironically, if he just plays it super conservatively, stays right at second base, that it's actually an easy hop to handle. They make that out easy. So it's Alejandro Kirk's throw needs to be better, obviously. But I think also, and that's why I think John Schneider's comments post-game were, was not laying it entirely at the feet of Kirk. He just said, we need to handle the ball better there. Because I think if IKF makes a different split-second decision, not an easy decision whatsoever, but if he kind of reads the situation, reads that runner, reads that throw, and just stays at home at second base where he was initially going, I think that inning's 1-1. I think it ends 1-1. So that part is really, really fascinating. But again, just taking it back to even the decision to throw, Toronto Blue Jays dating back 5-6 years, similar leverage. They've only thrown through one time. So one time out of like maybe 20 chances. So again, 5-10% throw through rate, self-calculated. But the only other time they did it, it was like a backup catcher running at third base.
A very slow runner at third where your risk-reward trade-off is not, it's not Blake Perkins with a good lead.
Yeah.
It's a slower runner who they're trying to see if they can get that second base for
super
free.
But again, that's a fascinating play because it's the best base running team in the league against the best defensive team in the league. And it's just like they're both trying to make things happen. Both managers make an aggressive decision. I view it, to use a bad poker analogy, like I view that as like all five cards are up, the river card's been turned, and somebody like Milwaukee running is making a big bet on the river. And, you know, the Jays could have folded and let them win that small pot, or they could have re-raised. And him, that was Schneider re-raising. That was Schneider throwing it right back at them.
Or I guess Kirk in that spot because...
Yeah, choosing to throw, yeah.
I'm sure he's got the... I mean, it's his decision at that point, right?
I don't think so. I think that's the play call beforehand. I think that's the play call before to throw through. So they make an aggressive re-raise right back at Milwaukee to throw through. And then Milwaukee... They could have the guy on third base could have just read the play, wait and see what happens with the ball. But he goes on first move. Again, mm-hmm. Another really aggressive play. They put it right back in Toronto's hands. Like, so I just view it as a poker hand where both guys were really aggressive. If it were me, and I'm a little bit of a less aggressive poker player by nature, like I would have picked my spots a little bit more. I like the aggression. I like selective aggression. I like going at that, maybe choosing a different moment, especially with the two elite base runners on base. But knowing Milwaukee's run into some outs in those scenarios before. And again, Toronto's handled that situation really well in the past. So I don't, with Contreras up, and especially seeing that they are willing to give up an out there, I don't hate that decision. Like, it was aggressive, but they're a very good defensive team. But end of the day, I just find it a really, really fascinating play with lots of layers to it.
It's also, it's fun baseball, right? Like, yeah. This is one of, like, the offensive environment being lower sucks, but the rules that they've changed to increase stolen base frequency, increase stolen base effectiveness, and the fact that when the run environment is lower, especially the home run environment is lower, the trade-offs for stolen bases changes, where you should be stealing more in a lower run environment because the cost of an out isn't as costly. You're not expecting, you know, the big inning or the big three-run home run nearly as often as a league. But also, like, this is probably the most frustrating part of this for me, is that, yes, the Blue Jays are a good defensive team. They're a good starting pitching team, but they are not a good base running team. They are sixth to last by Fangraph's base running metric. They are, you know, near the bottom in stolen base aggression. They're bottom 10 in stolen bases. They don't, and some of this is like the trade-offs they've had to make to try to get a little more bop in the lineup, but they are simultaneously a team that has, like, admitted for the entire season since Don Mattingly's like spring training comments, we're not going to hit a lot of home runs. We don't have a lot of those guys. You know, Ross Atkins kind of backed that up when he did media availability on that long weekend as well. The Jays are a team that's built to play more like the Brewers than like a three-run home run team, but they don't have the base running component of it, or at least they don't have enough of those guys. It's interesting. Like, obviously they're not built as like a fast team, but they shouldn't be a bottom five, bottom six base running team when you're also not a good home run hitting team or a good average hitting team.
Yeah, I think optimally you're
you should
not.
Probably be good at something,
think,
is what
I think
I'm saying.
Optimally you're not, but I think when you have Kirk, Guerrero, Turner, you know, those three guys are going to limit, and Vogelbach, or like those four guys on your roster, like, you have an upper limit to how good of a
base. But even then, like, Springer and Varsho are the only guys on the team who are like above average base runners. Like Kiermaier, I would assume if the sample expanded, he would get there. But right now, Springer and Varsho are the only guys who grade out as above average base runners. So, like,
yeah, Kiner Falefa is a good base runner. So I think that those numbers would normalize. Bo should be better, and I think he might be better than what he's been recently. But yeah, like, Milwaukee is, they're built to play this modern style of baseball, I think. Like, yeah, obviously if you can score six runs a game and hit a bunch of home runs, you would do that, but there are very few teams who can. And I really like how Milwaukee pivoted. Like, last year they were 15th in the league in base running, and they had guys like Josh Donaldson, Carlos Santana, Mike Brosseau, like a bunch of slow veterans on their team. Now, the difference being they had guys coming up through their system who were fast and athletic and ready to implement this style of baseball. So, you know, I think that's a style perfectly suited to today's game. And yeah, like last night or yesterday, perfect example of how you can utilize that stuff to put pressure on defenses. And when you put pressure on defenses, even the best ones in the game, sometimes they break, sometimes they make mistakes.
Yeah, it was a fun one. You mentioned Bo Bichette in there as well. Base running, not the only thing that's down for him a little bit this year. Let's take a break. When we come back, I know you put a Twitter thread out, but let's dive deep on Bo Bichette's season so far at the dish. As Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. All I need is some sunshine. All I need is Jays to have a nice little homestand here. Six games, three against the Guardians, three against the Red Sox. Chris Black, you'll be in the truck, which means you're at the Rogers Center, right?
I'm at the Rogers Center in the, like, loading dock. It's a very glamorous position.
Okay, you are in the area where Comerica lost power.
Yes.
So that's your fault if that were to ever happen here.
No. Why'd you remind me of that? I was producing in studio for that fun experience of calling Dan and Joe through our control room audio, getting them, talking to them. I mean, it was once in a lifetime, as was said many times that night afterwards, like, that's going in the book. That is coming 20 years from now or so.
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, let's talk about more, I guess, relevant things. I don't know why I set you up for that.
I like it.
Okay. Bo Bichette is not having a good season. I don't need to preamble or set it up in any kind of way. He's hitting 240. He has a 287 on base average, 346 slugging. All of those would be by far career worst marks. Even when we adjust for league average and park and all that stuff, there's no way to cut it that Bo Bichette is not having a bad offensive season so far. And we're 65 games in. This is, even if we looked at his entire career in 65 game segments, this is the worst 65 game stretch of his career. We'll just say it's the worst, I guess, almost half season at this point. There's no other way around it. And even like, yes, over the last 30 days, technically he's been league average. Almost all of that is concentrated in like one really good week he had at the end of May. And he's kind of gone back to some of the poorer habits and some of the lesser outcomes here. So there's a lot going on. Anytime a player this talented is hitting below their level, you seem to have isolated, though, that this is a problem primarily earlier in counts.
You hit the nail on the head. Like, not only is it the worst season he's had, but like, if you just don't even look at full seasons, like, this is the worst stretch of his career, like worst extended stretch of his career. And the dialogue around Bo this season, at least what it seems like for me observing from the sidelines, is like not much has really changed. What's really going on? He's not really chasing much more. The swing decisions, you know, he's always been uber aggressive and that hasn't really changed. So not what is going on. It's kind of a mystery. And while that the overall numbers, that might suggest that's true. But if you split up his season in one of two ways, you find things have really changed.
I do also, I get what you're saying, that like people have almost hand washed away. Well, there's no smoking gun in the data, so we don't know what's wrong. I do also think there is a small element of Bo has been a streaky hitter in his career. Yep. And because he is such a high level bat to ball guy generally, there is an assumption that whatever it is, he'll figure it out. Yeah. But we're now at 65 games. Yeah. I was using that as a talking point. Like 30 games in, I get asked in the text line, are you seeing much? And I'm like, I'm not seeing a ton. Nothing that, you know, after 30 games, I'm like, yeah, he'll figure it out. He's Bo Bichette. But yeah, we're far enough in now that we can dig into. And this is the other thing is like the further into a slump you are, the more meaningful the ways we can split things up are. Yeah. Because if you're looking at like five games and we pull, you know, the splits by where you are in the count and stuff like that, it's probably going to be pretty noisy. Half a season, less noisy. So we are not ready to conclude that nothing has changed. We can dig in a little further and see both one thing that he's still doing very well and one area where it's gotten significantly worse.
Yeah, you can break it up in one of two ways, either behind in the count versus ahead in the count, or with two strikes or not with two strikes. And with two strikes, which is this, you know, the way we've kind of lionized Bo recently, he's the same hitter. Like he's the same Bo as he's been in years past, maybe even better. But before two strikes, he's way worse. And like, that's the strange part. Like,
he's actually better with two strikes than before two strikes this year, which, look, it's a great strength to be good with two strikes,
yeah,
to be defensive, to be able to extend plate appearances. You know, that lets you be a little aggressive earlier in at-bats because you're fine if you get to two strikes. But you're not supposed to be better in bad counts than you are in good counts.
So if you're listening on a pod or listening on the radio, there's a graphic up on television that says before two strikes, he's slugging 345. Now that's the lowest on the Blue Jays. No one else is below 400. And that ranks 194th out of 195 hitters in baseball. So that just doesn't make sense. It makes no sense for you to have more home runs with two strikes versus not. Doesn't make any sense to be slugging higher with two strikes compared to with zero or one strike. So it's just, these numbers don't make sense. And it's across the board, right? It's his chase rate. It's how often he's swinging outside of the zone before two strikes. All those numbers are spiking this year. So it doesn't make sense to me. If it was something mechanical, I feel like the numbers would be down across the board and two strike Bo would be struggling too. I think it's something philosophical isn't the right way. I think it's something up in his head, like how he's approaching these at-bats. Is he trying to do too much before two strikes? Does he, when he works himself into a good hitter's count, or even like first pitch, 1-0, 2-0, like one of the microcosms of his season that I kind of isolated was in 2-0 counts. So he's worked his way into 2-0 counts. He doesn't see a lot of 2-0 counts, But when he's been in 2-0 counts this year, he does not have a base hit, which is insane to me.
Now, he doesn't have a single hit when he's
he doesn't have a hit in the 2-0 count. And we're showing some swings again on television here of 2-0 counts. It's bad swing decisions. It's swinging on the edges. It's chasing. It's also like you're seeing these aren't classic Bo Bichette swings where I think eye test, untrained Oshawa baseball alumnus, not pro baseball alumnus. The swing looks big, front flip high, flying open. I think it when he works himself into a hitter's count, he's expecting, hoping, trying to do too much. And I think if he, I think a takeaway from this, from these numbers, when you look at them, is I'm not saying go full two-strike approach all the way through, but if he just incorporated a little bit more of that battling. So there's some pro athletes who are just better when their back's against the wall. When they're down a couple runs, when they're down a set in tennis, there are a lot of tennis players who play better down a set than or down a break versus up a break. So I think that might just be Bo Bichette's, maybe he's just better when he thinks his back is against the wall, when he's two strikes and he's battling. But these numbers, they don't philosophically in everything we know about baseball, it doesn't make sense. There shouldn't be, if you look at, if you break down his production this season, even by zero strikes, one strike, two strike, he gets better as the strike total goes up in his counts, which again, just doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. And look, there are two possible explanations. There are a lot of possible explanations, but the two I will entertain here for the purposes of this is one is that when you, yes, there's the back against the wall, you're better with two strikes. There's also an element of like, once you get to two strikes, whatever your plan was for earlier in the plate appearance, you set it aside because you're in like survival mode, right? You're like, okay, I'm going to expand at the edges to foul off. And Bo Bichette, for like the millionth time in a row, is like right near the top of the league in foul balls. Now, some of that happens before two strikes, and it's like, well, you just missed on a swing. You swung at something bad. We've all seen those, you know, the slider breaking low and away, first pitch in the count, and it gets kind of flailed at down the right field line. Those aren't good fouls, but he's consistently near the top of the league in two-strike fouling off, staying alive. So maybe once it gets to that, maybe he is making a conscious effort to do different things earlier in the count, and it's only once he gets to two strikes that he's kind of forced into, well, what is my natural state? I'm simplified here. I'm playing defensive. Now, you don't want him to be defensive all the time because, like we've said, and part of the issue in analyzing Bo Bichette with swing decisions and stuff like that is he's good aggressive. When he's at his best, he's making pitchers uncomfortable because you can't get something over. He's going to jump on it. But before we get to two strikes, we're seeing some troubling signs in terms of, and not to overdo the swing decisions things, because I think this year has really taught us that, like, yes, that is a helpful thing, but it's not the goal as a whole, as a player or as a team. But it's still a way that we can measure things. And before two strikes, we're seeing Bo swing at things that he could probably wait on. And so he would not care what I had to say. But my thought would be, if you are a very good two-strike hitter, yes, that lets you be more aggressive early in counts, because if you swing and miss, who cares, right? I can still hit well with two strikes. But I would probably lean toward being a little bit more selective right now while I figure this out, because he's swinging and not doing damage on stuff around the edges to like that, like, hey, it's on the edge of the strike zone and it's probably a strike, but you're not going to do damage on it. He's swinging at a lot of those, right?
Yeah, 100%. Swinging more than ever this season. And also,
those are the pitches you swing at to stay alive two strikes, not what you try to jump on early in a count. At least if you're a good two strike hitter to me, that's maybe more of like, hey, I'm going to take this and it's borderline, but I'm comfortable hitting with two strikes. So that, like, a called strike is not going to get to me.
Yeah. It's interesting. Before two strikes, if a pitch is thrown to the edge of the strike zone, so within a ball width of the edge of the zone, you are league wide. You're better off just not swinging. Like, there are better results if you let that pitch go by versus swinging at it.
As Justin Turner said recently to Shai Davidi, you're better off being 0-1 than 0-4-1.
Yeah, 100%. Great way of putting it. And one of the ways you can measure this with Bo is before two strikes on pitches outside of the heart of the zone, so more than one ball width inside the strike zone, only one or two guys in baseball have made more outs on those types of pitches. So he's getting himself out before he needs to just a little bit too often. He's never going to be, we're not asking him to be Justin Turner, not asking him to be Juan Soto. He's always going to be somewhere ranked near the top, but it's just we've seen those numbers spike before two strikes this year. There was an example that I showed on that Twitter thread of an at-bat early in the year against Tampa where first pitch, they see if he's going to fish. They're going fishing. They're seeing if he's going to chase outside of the zone.
Exactly the type of swing people gripe about. It's a low and away breaking ball that even if you got to it, like best case scenario, you're probably flaring that into right for a single, and that's like a low percentage outcome on a pitch like that.
He takes first pitch, ball one, great. Next pitch, the exact same spot, 2-0, really good outcome. Now, 2-0 count, you've taken twice in a row. What happens? The pitcher goes outside the zone again, same spot, down and away, and he gets a chase, and Bo pops out. And you can see the pitcher react. The pitcher claps.
It's Aaron Civale, who is in the middle of a really rough start to the season, too.
But he's a command guy who can put the ball wherever he wants. And he knew, jumping into his head and speculating, he didn't feel like he needed to give in to Bo in order to get a swing and get an out. And I think if you look at the numbers, if you look at the heat maps before two strikes for Bo, what you're seeing is pitchers are realizing they don't need to give in, even in hitters counts. That if they throw to the edge, is it an anxiety level? I don't know. He's gonna swing at those because he's trying to make things happen. Bo's a good hitter. That two strike approach shows that. His track record over 4 or 5 years shows that. But just something right now, he's a little antsy before two strikes. That's what it looks like to me.
And unfortunately, I mean, I don't know how Bo is wired, but when I am anxious, as I am often, if you tell me to be less anxious, guess what that's going to make me do?
Exactly. It's like when I tell my kids to calm down. Strangely enough, they don't calm down.
No, it's funny. I had a chat with Michael Bauman of Fangraphs a couple weeks ago. He spoke to Davis Schneider when they were in Philly. And, you know, Davis Schneider got asked a little bit about, and I'm paraphrasing here, but got asked, you know, how do you handle clutch situations? Well, like your performance is pretty steady. And he was like, well, I'm nervous all the time. So there's not a big change.
Major League Baseball would be incredibly nerve-wracking.
Right. So my theory coming away from this and what Michael Bauman and I talked about was like, clutch is not necessarily the absence of anxiety or nervousness in a situation. It's how that compares to like just your baseline level, where if you're, this is not related to Boba Chef, by the way, this is just related to performance anxiety in sport generally.
I will say like this is a bit of an aside, but like, I feel like baseball is the most anxiety provoking sport, not only for fans, but even like for the players, like failure for hitters, especially.
Think about the 15 seconds you're standing in a box after you just swung and missed, and now you're dealing with two strikes. Like, imagine you swing and miss at 100 on the end. You've got 15 seconds to sit there with it, and you're down to the last strike.
But what is success now? Like, one hit in five trips is like what a lot of guys are doing now.
Yeah, the league is hitting .241. It's gross.
Yeah, dealing with that much failure would be very, very hard. And sometimes it's kind of, what it kind of reminds me of is a little bit, because I work on tennis a lot as well. Like, there's nothing you can do when you're playing tennis against a high-end player, especially if you're returning serve. If Milos Raonic at his peak puts three or four serves in perfect spots, or even for a whole set, if he's serving well, there is absolutely nothing you can do. And it's the same way if a pitcher executes his pitches properly, and if they have good, there's almost nothing you can do at times. Like, you need to take advantage of almost every mistake that comes your way, and that's hard to do. Sometimes you'll miss. So I have the utmost respect for all these guys, and like, I can sympathize to what like a struggling baseball player is going through. But yeah, I found this stuff fascinating with Bo when I dove in, because it was such a glaring difference between two-strike Bo and before two-strike Bo.
It's why I love reading books about kind of the mental side of tennis or baseball. Sean Green actually wrote a really good book on this when he retired, called The Tao of Baseball. And then there's also The Inner Game of Tennis, which is kind of the classic performance and mental performance in sport book by Timothy Galway. So Bo's in a bad spot. Obviously, we're going to be looking for what's happening earlier in the count as we head into this Guardians series this weekend. I know there was one other player you had some notes on, Tim Mesa. Rough one yesterday, but obviously trying to clean up a mess there that was already created coming into a tough spot. He was on a run of pretty good performance, though. I know that when his ERA was up over six, you had felt fairly confident that he would be able to turn that around. What have you seen from Meza lately?
With Meza, I really liked, he's kind of toyed with using the slider more, I think out of necessity recently. He's just a guy who was very good for 2-3 years, but also like, I think Meza's a really good example of like the variability of bullpens and like why you can't bank on year-to-year success for the vast majority of guys. Like he's used a lot of bullets in that shoulder, and I'm not sure how many bullets are in there right now, where he's just the fastball or the sinker doesn't seem to have the same amount of jump. And I just think
it's also down a mile and a half an hour. And when you already only throw 93.
Yeah, like he was never a guy who relied on velo, but I think the velo played a part in the shape of that slider.
There's a shelf, too, right? Of like, you don't have to rely on velocity, but once it gets, like, if you're throwing at 93, your margin for error or your margin for the ability for that velocity slide. Like if Zach Pop loses a tick, bad example after yesterday, but if he loses a tick off of his sinker, that 98 becomes 97. That's a big difference than 92 becoming 91.
Yeah. And I just think Meza is kind of emblematic of a few different Blue Jays relievers in that a lot was asked of them over the last 2 or 3 years. It seems like he might be paying the price a little bit for that now.
Yeah, Eric Swanson, by the way, not having a good time in AAA either. So another example there, and Jordan Romano is on the IL. So the Jays are going to do, they have a TBA on Saturday. It'll be some combination of Bowden Francis, the bullpen, and potentially Yariel Rodriguez on a day short rest. That probably frees Trevor Richards up. I mean, they used him Tuesday and Wednesday, so that should probably tell, and they pitched him 3 times in 4 days. That should probably tell us that he's not in the long man consideration anymore. Where is he? Like, is he your in the 7th, 8th mix with Chad Green? And like really, it's Jimmy Garcia, Chad Green, and then maybe Trevor Richards that are kind of like in the John Schneider trust tree at this point, right?
Yeah, 100%.
That's thin.
100% it is when Romano's not right and Swanson's down. But yeah, Trevor Richards for me is definitely in that mix. He's an interesting case. It's kind of like it's Kevin Gausman reliever, right? Like, whereas it's two pitches, and sometimes if he doesn't have the feel for one, or if one team has just completely decided to not swing at one of those two types of pitches, you need to see him and the catcher kind of think on the fly and kind of go to like some kind of extreme game plan of like, I'm going to throw a ton of fastballs here today. So things are a little wacky with him. He's not a classic reliever by any stretch, but he's been great. I'm number one on the Trevor Richards in the Trevor Richards fan club. But yeah, for Saturday, I think it's going to be a Francis and Rodriguez thing where they, you know, do they handcuff those two guys together for the time being? Maybe. I liked what I saw from Francis his last time out. I did a thread on Francis last week or maybe a week and a half ago that was essentially, you know, we talked about Bo splitting his season up into by count with Bowden. If you split all the pitches he's thrown this season by height, and if you just call one section high pitches and one section low pitches, when he keeps the ball down, he's been good. I think Houston and New York targeted fastballs up and kind of breaking balls that kind of popped up and kind of stayed middle of the zone, but at least ball out of hand. Like, I think the early strategy against Bowden was one eye level. And I think in his last outing especially, he was changing that eye level, not only with breaking balls, but mixing in some fastballs down. He's had really good results keeping that ball down around the knees, around kind of just the lower, again, it's not even like right at the bottom of the zone, just lower half of the zone. He's been good. So if he can do that with both breaking balls and fastballs, he's not as good as the first 20 games of his career, obviously. but he's also nowhere near as bad as what those first few outings of the season showed.
It'll be interesting to see if and when he shifts into a multi-inning bullpen role, because, you know, I'd assume they'll probably, if they're going to pitch both of them, probably Yariel starts. He's just primarily been starting. Not that it really, really matters.
Yeah.
Maybe some stuff in the matchups against Cleveland. But one of the ways that Bowden Francis could help his breaking stuff low in the zone play even better, because both of his breaking balls move kind of right to left right now, and the fastball that comes out high in the zone, would be to add a splitter, because a splitter is going to move, you know, the movement profile is going to be different than his curveball. And we know that fastballs high and splitters low coming out of the hand, if you tunnel them well, are deceptive. That's why Kevin Gausman tends to throw his fastball very high. That's why a lot of splitter guys do. But if Francis were to move into, say, a two-inning role in the bullpen, maybe not a lot of time to unleash a fourth pitch that you're mostly only using to lefties, right?
Yeah, no, probably not. But I like that pitch. I like what I've seen. If he's a multi-inning guy, it'll definitely play, definitely against lefties. Even in those games he was struggling, he got really good hitters out with that splitter early in the year. He got Kyle Tucker out with splitters. He got Juan Soto out with a splitter. So I like the pitch. The danger with a pitch that a young pitcher is learning how to use and with a changeup or a splitter is that sometimes, and we saw this with Alek Manoah in his first few years in the league, sometimes you throw that pitch and it just does nothing and it stays in the middle and you get burned by it. So that's the danger with it. But I like it as a way of neutralizing lefties for sure.
We'll see that probably on Saturday unless the Jays change plans a little bit. We're done for today. No game tonight. The Blue Jays with their first off day in a while. Chris Black, thanks for doing this, man.
Anytime.
Thank you to Chris Black for coming on, to Kylie McDaniel of ESPN, to Keegan Matheson of BlueJays.com. Thanks, as always, to Lance Kennedy, Amit Mann, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blue Jays off tonight. We will be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. to set up this Guardians series for you. It'll be Kevin Gausman against Logan Allen on Friday, TBA against Carlos Carrasco, Jose Berríos against Ben Lively on Sunday. Yeah, join us tomorrow, 10 a.m. We'll break it all down. Have a great Thursday, everyone.